Hello, you're listening to the inaugural episode of They Came from the North.
Ooh.
A uniquely Canadian perspective on some of those big directors that you may have heard of or may not have heard of, as well as just some film-centric rambling from a few Canadians. With me, I've got, from the East Coast, Mr. John Mercer. From Central Canada, I guess we'll say, or from, slightly west of East Coast, I've got Mr. Gabriel Girard. How did I do?
Bonjour.
Pronunciation?
That's okay. I don't know how to say it in English either.
He's crying.
And from the west, from out in the Wild West, we've got Mr. Andrew Forbes.
Ahoy, hoy.
I know those of you who frequent the DVD Verdict website and the jury room may recognize some of these guys. We've all been poking around there for quite a while. Hopefully what we want to do with this little exercise in podcast insanity is we want to bring to your attention a director each week. We call it, you know, a director spotlight or what have you. This week for our inaugural episode, we've chosen a man who these days doesn't really have a whole lot of name recognition, but in the late 70s was something of a Hollywood hot boy, and in the 80s churned out a lot of, you know, reliable, solid action flicks that wound up, I think it's fair to say, kind of being lost in the miasma of 1980s home video, you know, how bloated shelves were in rental locations and stuff like that, you know, the big budget.
Ironic, because arguably this guy kind of created the style that a lot of these schlocky 80s movies were built on.
Yeah, and we're talking about director Walter Hill. He got his rise, he got his start with a Steve McQueen film called The Getaway. He was actually originally hired to co-write with Peter Bogdanovich, who Steve McQueen fired before reading even a single word of the screenplay, apparently. So I have no idea what went on there. I don't know about this rivalry between McQueen and Bogdanovich, but hey.
His last name.
Maybe that's what it was. I don't know. But he got his start.
I can't see them hanging out after hours a lot.
Yeah, the McQueen and Hill became friends. He was brought to the attention of John Wayne and was offered offered a directing chair on John Wayne's final movie, but he refused on the grounds that he didn't want to see his hero dying on film. He was supposed to direct the original Alien and actually turned in a draft of that screenplay before Ridley Scott stepped in. And he made his debut in, I think it was 75? Was it 75?
I think so.
With Hard Times, which is a Depression-era boxing piece starring Chuck Bronson. Some other trivia?
And James Colburn.
And James Colburn,
of his batch of films, I'd have to say Hard Times is probably my favorite. I don't know, it's very controlled movie, very pared down stylistically. It's not flashy. He doesn't try to show his chops. He just lets the story run out. The dialogue is amazing. I mean, Colburn is really a force in that movie. He's very charismatic. He's sly. He's funny. And I don't know. It's like the old stranger coming into town and going into the fights. The fights felt very real. And Bronson is at his heart-kicking best. I mean, you know. I don't know how to explain it.
He's Charles Bronson.
Yeah, he's Charles Bronson.
He had a few other, you know, kind of underground hits in the 1970s that went on to greater, much, much greater things. He had The Driver, which, of course, we were talking about Drive earlier, and stylistically and thematically, both of those movies are definitely strongly linked. He had The Warriors in 79, which was, you know, I mean, probably his most well-known film. He went on to a string of stuff in the 1980s. He had The Long Riders, Southern Comfort, both of which, you know, most people don't generally remember these days. Streets of Fire, 48 Hours, which was, up to that point, that was his big arrival. That was, you know, it basically single-handedly created the buddy cop genre and did so in a more realistic and action-focused, like approach than most of the comedies that had followed, you know, stuff like Running Scared and Lethal Weapon and Midnight Run. Like, they were more humor based, whereas 48 Hours was a much more gritty film. You know, of course, it had a young Eddie Murphy, which did bring that comedic touch, but I mean, you can see that that was the formula right there. That was the creation. He had Brewster's Millions, which was some would call it a misfire, I guess, but you know, it was a rare comedy in what is usually a pretty dark oeuvre of films. We had Crossroads, which was a bit of an oddball. Extreme Prejudice, which is basically a modern-day retelling of The Wild Bunch. The Arnold Schwarzenegger vehicle, Red Heat, where if you want to see Arnold play, you know, a hard-ass Russian. Johnny Handsome, which was fairly notable for early Mickey Rourke. You know, it was kind of one of those movies he was pretty well known for. Another 48 Hours came along in 1990, kicked off his 90s. It was, and remains to this day, I believe, his highest-grossing film. And after that, he kind of settled down a little bit. He had Trespass, which I believe was a troubled production, and I think was going under another name originally and was delayed because of the L.A. riots.
It was originally called Looters, I believe. Looters, and that's sort of why they chose the name change after the L.A. riots. They thought, you know, I don't know why they thought that was going to be a bad business move. I mean, if anything, I would think maybe it would get people in seats, but who knows?
He had a few Westerns. He had Geronimo and Wild Bill at a time when Westerns were completely out of vogue. Last Man Standing in 96, which was Bruce Willis' Prohibition-era retelling of Yojimbo, which is probably the last real success on his resume. After that was Supernova, which, of course, he had his name removed from. Undismuted, which was a direct-to-video Wesley Snipes boxing flick. Broken Trail, which was an AMC miniseries. And his last real notable work, I think, was he directed the pilot episode of HBO's Deadwood and also served as the creative consultant for the first season. So he kind of established the look and at least the atmosphere of Deadwood. Of course, he's also got upcoming Bullet to the Head, which we talked about a little earlier before the show. Sylvester Stallone, actioner. I can't remember who's playing the bad guy.
Jason Momoa,
yeah. The guy from
Christian Slater is in it.
God.
Stallone's partner in it is Sung Kang, who's just coming off of Fast Five. You know, he's pretty up-and-coming,
an
actor.
Yeah. So we'll get each of your thoughts on Walter Hill. I mean, Gabriel, you chimed in already on Hard Times. I guess you'd pick that as your good Walter Hill choice.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if it's really my favorite or if it's because it's the first one I saw. But I still think it's a superior film and a very impressive debut.
I probably put it in my top five debut films, actually.
I really enjoyed Hard Times, actually, and it's just that's one of the things I keep going back to with I think is really lacking for movies nowadays is you don't just get this, you know, this whole aura that used to come off of our action heroes. Right? And when you got Bronson and Coburn on camera together, I mean, there's enough testosterone there to make a sandwich, right?
How about
well,
you?
Sadly, this is one of the ones I wasn't able to see, so I'm going to have to leave it with your thoughts, guys. But I'm definitely going to have to check it out at some point.
How about you, Jim? What would you pick as your good?
I was going to go with 48 Hours, but I think you pretty much said everything that could have been said about it, so I'm going to go with one of people probably a lot of people haven't aren't familiar with these days, and that's Extreme Prejudice from 87.
Awesome flick.
His like you said, his kind of spiritual successor to The Wild Bunch. Extreme Prejudice, when you look at it, should have been an unholy mess of a movie. Right? You've got like it really appears schizophrenic from the outside. You've got two completely separate plot lines that just kind of converge together for convenience sake. Right? On the one hand, you got the plot between the two former childhood friends who both traveled separate paths once the halcyon days of their youth came to an end, and now they stand face to face on the opposite sides of the law. And when after just saying that, I got to wonder if Elmore Leonard and the makers of Justified were big fans of Extreme Prejudice. That's pretty much the first season of Justified, right?
It kind of is, yeah. Yeah, it does kind of have a bit of the same feel.
And then on top of that, you've got John Milius' ultimate wet dream about the Networks team all thought KIA, all secretly pulling off these black bag operations for years. And now they're all reunited on their latest mission that leads them toward a head-on collision with Nick Nolte's hard-nosed lawman. These are two scenarios that would have made two perfectly functional lower-tier late 80s action movies. You know, I could definitely see Chuck Norris starring in the one about
the black bag team.
The black bag team and the hard-nosed lawman. However, when you combine it all together with Hill's still slick directions, his 80s style direction, you know, I said this is the guy who kind of created the look and feel of 80s action movies, and I'll still stand by that. How much of Lethal Weapon, or how much 48 Hours do you see in Lethal Weapon?
Right? A lot.
It's written in the DNA. So you got Hill's slick direction, you got Milius's, at the time, his still mean and nasty writing. And I mean,
I think Milius is still mean and nasty. He's only got one speed. Bastard.
Extreme Prejudice's cast was awesome, outside of Maria Conchita Alonso.
That's not fair, John.
Well, to be fair, she's the only one who doesn't really have a character.
Yeah.
Oh, no, she has a character. It's Maria Conchita Alonso. They told me about the documentary. Yeah. It's just, Extreme Prejudice should have been a Lone Wolf McQuaid-style cheese fest. And especially in the wake of Arnold Schwarzenegger. But it just, it really, really just works as this unfairly forgotten 80s action classic.
Just gritty.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, gritty, you know, speaks to Hill's strengths. That
gunfight at the end of it.
What was that?
I think it speaks to Hill's strengths, you know, that he didn't really buy into that Arnold Schwarzenegger mode of 80s masculinity, the, like, Muscle Beach kind of... you know, it's all about big muscles and greased up guys. And you know, he was about, you know, workaday guys going and getting it done. And, I mean, when you have a cast, like you've got Powers Booth, you've got Nick Nolte, you've got Michael Ironside, Rip Torn,
a pre-mustache William Forsythe.
Yeah.
I mean, even the bad guy is well-characterized. Too. I mean, he's an interesting guy. He's not the typical cliche cold lord, you know?
Yeah, he's not just there twirling his mustache.
And Powers Booth, really, I think, you know, the movie could have been kind of humorless and a bit of a chore, but he really saves it, especially towards the end. He's got, you know, a couple of lines that are just hysterical.
That's just Powers
Booth. You know, he's setting up this duel with Nolte, and he's getting mad at Maria Conchita Alonso because she's starting to cry and ruining the whole tone. Which is just brilliant, I think.
Powers Booth, to me, is one of these guys that Hollywood kind of missed the boat on. Right? You see some of his earlier work, and you're like, gee, why wasn't this guy a bigger star?
I think, you know, he's the kind of guy who, even when he was young, he was an older guy. You know, he didn't have... I don't think you could sort of bring him up as a young movie star. He just suddenly became this kind of granite, grizzled kind of guy, and I'm sure that the studios didn't know quite how to sell that.
It's like Richard Burton in the sequel.
Richard Burton was 28 and looked like he was 50. Powers Booth got a face on him, looks like he was chiseled out of a tree. And then you got Nick Nolte, who, what was his character? Jack Benteen?
Yeah.
You know, is that the man is the very definition of hard ass.
Good flick.
I think probably literally in this movie. He looks like, you know, he basically bends at the joints, and other than that, he's just made of rock.
And Last Gunfight, in a year that brought us RoboCop, I honestly think that Extreme Prejudice almost rivals it for squib use.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely very bloody.
Voting out of people.
And you can see the callback. I mean, in that, certainly, and the way the finale is filmed, it is absolutely a callback to the Wild Bunch.
Oh, it is. It's pure Peckinpah.
It's the Wild Bunch with Uzis.
What can you ask for?
How about you, Andrew? What do you have for your good?
My good, again, bringing Powers Booth into it, is Southern Comfort, which is one of those movies that absolutely should be known better and... I don't think it's really pointed to as one of the great Vietnam movies, which it is, even though it takes place in Louisiana. It's about this group of guys who are in the National Guard. They go into the swamps on an exercise. You know, you've got some real idiots in there who decide it would be fun to shoot at some hunters they see with some blanks. The hunters obviously don't know this. They shoot back, hit the leader of the group in the head, kill him. And from then on, it's basically this group of guys lost in the swamps trying to get out. So you've got a well-equipped, well-trained group of American soldiers against a native group who are not as well-trained and not as well-supplied, but they're on their own turf. So it's pretty obvious what it's referring to.
Oh, for sure.
But at the same time, you know, one of the nice things about Hill, I don't mean to piss you off here, Steve, by going after Oliver Stone, but
it's okay.
You know, he's absolutely not a political filmmaker. I think he saw the connection absolutely, but he's more interested in looking at, you know, what you get when you put a bunch of young guys, obviously some clashing personalities together. You know, get them out of their element, give them guns, and take away their leadership. What happens, you know? And the nice thing about it is it doesn't break down into that stereotypical war movie character set. To a degree it does, but it's not the religious guy, the redneck, the joker, the college boy. I mean, those are all elements that exist in there, but, you know, the really moral guy is a little bit dim, but then he kind of goes off the deep end. Powers Booth is the college boy, I guess you'd call him. He's an engineer by day. But as opposed to being, you know, meek or, you know, seeming totally out of his element, it's more just that he's really, really not happy in that situation. He kind of hates it. He's really, aggressive towards the other guys. He sort of comes out as a bit of the hero along with Keith Carradine. But it's not just the stock character set. And you've got a really interesting backdrop in the Cajun country. Towards the end, they end up in a small Cajun community. And you get some nice, almost documentary sort of footage of a bit of a party going on. You know, there's dancing. And at the same time, it's cutting back and forth between this maybe oblivious, maybe conspiratorial community doing their little party, and then Powers Booth and Keith Carradine, you know, looking out the window, wondering if these hunters that were tracking them are going to come back in and try to finish them off. You know, are they safe in the open? Are they not? So overall, it's just there's just a ton of great material in the setting, and it's executed really well. So a good and very rich kind of action movie, not just dumb action, but really well done.
My observation on Southern Comfort, and this is more of a technical observation, Hill's movies always have a really dark look, I find. Like, almost, really sparse lighting. He films, like, a lot of natural light, that kind of stuff, and he uses a lot of shadow. But Southern Comfort just had this dark, overcast look to it. It was almost oppressive.
It's really, in tone, this is a bit of a simplification, and I'm sorry for breaking out the DVD cover blurb kind of approach, but it really feels like Deliverance meets Platoon.
Yeah, definitely.
It is so bleak and so tense all the way through.
Yeah.
There's in the swamp.
This is true.
And again, you've got a great cast. You've got Powers Booth. You've got Keith Carradine, Fred Ward, Peter Coyote, the late, great Brian James, a.k.a. Leon from Blade Runner.
Yeah.
as the one-armed, possibly guilty, possibly wrongly accused Cajun hunter. So on all levels, it's really, really good.
I've got to go. You know, I like a lot of Hill stuff. I'm a big Walter Hill fan. I have been for a while. And, I mean, you know, I love The Driver is fantastic. Hard Times is fantastic. Extreme Prejudice, you know, 48 Hours, Southern Comfort, The Long Riders, to me, is one of the great classic forgotten westerns. But I ultimately have to go with, And again, this is kind of in the same territory as Gabriel. Not necessarily his best film, but definitely my favorite. I've got to go with Streets of Fire. It's just such a stylishly directed, just beautiful looking film. And this, you know, this almost rock opera 1950s/1980s style that it has to it. I find it ridiculously infectious. Like, as soon as I turn it on, you know, it's young Diane Lane runs out on stage and starts singing, and the movie has me. I am in its clutches, and I am there for the next, you know, 110 or whatever minutes until it's over. And it's got one of those great, you know, final scenes, those really fantastic final scenes. It's almost like that whole, you know, that Jack Burton turn at the end of Big Trouble in Little China where, you know, aren't you going to kiss her? Nope. And he just walks out the door. You know, it's got this great exit from the main character, from Tom Cody, you know, played by Michael Paré. And it really sets up that character as a great anti-hero who should have really popped up in more movies, just like Jack Burton. You know, like it's in a decade that gave us great action characters, Tom Cody was a really awesome character and he should have been used more. You know, he just should have popped up again. And he, like, the plan was to do two sequels, but of course, fickle Hollywood being what it is, have riding on the success of 48 Hours wasn't enough to make Streets of Fire a hit. So sadly, that was all we ever got. But I just, as an exercise in style, it's just such a great movie to watch. The characters are just so fun. I mean, yeah, it's got a little bit of that 80s cheese in there, you know, like it is a bit more of a...
I'm talking about Bill Paxton, are you?
No, hey, don't diss the Paxton factor. No, it does feel like more of a mainstream movie, I guess, than what Walter Hill typically churns out. Like, it is definitely, I think, I mean, I don't know, this is just hearsay on my part, but I think this was his shot at the big time. This was his, you know, attempt to make a big summer blockbuster, his attempt to really kind of put both feet into the mainstream. And I really wish it had paid off for him, but it just, in the end, you know, that's not in his DNA. You look at the rest of his body of work, and Streets of Fire, it just kind of, that and The Warriors really stand out like purple thumbs. You know, it's so...
To be fair, you know, he was trying to jump to the mainstream by doing a 50s rock and roll, futuristic, retro, simultaneously 80s music action movie.
Yeah.
Oh, God, you got to understand, you got to remember, we're looking at the 80s. There was a lot of 80s swung around. And honestly, to tell you the truth, with some of the stuff that came out of the early 80s, I can really see him pitching Streets of Fire and people seeing dollar signs.
Yeah, I could see, like, I mean, riding on stuff like, I mean, stuff that would have came later, like Back to the Future and again, Big Trouble in Little China, which, no, wasn't successful at the time, but became huge afterwards. Or like Buckaroo Banzai, or what was the one Fred Ward was in?
Remo
Williams. You know, like, all these movies were pretty big hits. I could have seen Streets of Fire. Like, it should have had more of a future than it did. I think a lot of it might have been circumstance. I don't know if it came up against something else that was really huge that summer.
That's or what. That was the summer of 84, man. That was Back to the Future, Ghostbusters. I can't remember if Beverly Hills Cop was that summer or not, but... 84 was a record setter.
So it must have been another, like, John Carpenter syndrome, you know?
Yeah.
We had Temple of Doom in 84, too.
Yeah, just poor timing.
Carpenter does the best work of his career. Unfortunately, E.T. also came out that year.
Yeah, and everybody was used to cute and cuddly aliens by the time the thing debuted.
You know, looking at Streets of Fire, Steve, it's kind of interesting that, you know, you talked about Walter Hill and using, you know, dark and gritty and lots of natural light. I think there's sort of two Walter Hills. There's that, and then there's the neon-drenched kind of urban Walter Hill.
Still, which shadows in Streets of Fire, though. Hill does these great shots. He did it all the time with James Remar in 48 Hours, and he kind of Ed Begley's bum character in Streets of Fire.
Yeah.
He does these great shots where the guy's face is kind of like the old Clint Eastwood westerns. All you can see are the eyes. The rest of it's just washed in gloom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't shoot movies like that anymore. I love that stuff.
That's the thing about Streets of Fire that I find interesting. At the same time, it's like this bossy wannabe blockbuster, but at the same time, it's Western, too.
It's just so dark.
Directs it like a Western.
Yeah, Walter Hill has said that himself, that, you know, pretty much every film he's made essentially is a Western, and you can kind of see it.
Mm-hmm. I love the scene when Tom Cody gives the money back and says she ain't worth it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That just, you know, that was a Steve McQueen moment right there.
I'm a big fan of Streets of Fire. And, I mean, it's one of those movies that there's some really trashy movies out there that when I watch them and they're done, I feel like $1 million, and Streets of Fire is one of them. You know, like when those credits roll at the end of Streets of Fire, I just feel so awesome. I feel so jazzed after watching that movie, you know? Up next, we'll...
it's definitely in my top five.
Yeah?
Yeah, number four.
So now we'll kick it off with The Bad. And now with this, I'm kind of thinking not so much an out-and-out bad movie, just, you know, a flawed work that you enjoy but can very clearly see the chinks in the armor, the flaws, so to speak. We'll start with you, Gabe.
Well, I like to go with The Warriors. I know this is, like, kind of controversial, but I didn't get into it at all. I just felt it wasn't really interesting. You know, the characters weren't interesting. It's just a big chase movie without, you know, anything for it to stand out.
That is definitely a controversial view, you know, given that I think it's probably the one movie, maybe in part due to the Rockstar game. But, you know, it's probably his best known, I'd say, now.
Definitely now, yeah.
Yeah.
Most people.
Well, I can see that. You know, I can see Gabriel's view on that, you know, given that there aren't really super fleshed out characters, and it is effectively, you know, a really minimalist retelling of who wrote that myth? Classic Greek, you know, the guys, small group running away from big group. And I can certainly see that, but when I see it, there's just so much atmosphere. There's so much, it's so cleanly directed and with so many, really great stylish touches that, you know, I just find myself going back to it all the time. And that is the theatrical cut, not the director's cut.
The director's cut is just
an atrocity.
Yeah. We will not speak of that.
Well, I think also since I viewed his movies in chronological order, I was coming up from Our Times and The Driver, and I wasn't, like, ready for a glossy kind of picture, you know? I was expecting the same style of pared-down stylistic choices and atmosphere and gritty characters, and there's none of that in The Warriors.
It is fair. Whenever James Remar opens his mouth, I want to punch my TV in that movie.
Nothing wrong with nailing some strange wool.
Oh, God.
No, I could definitely see where he's coming from. I could kind of get behind that statement, actually. There is, it's extremely shallow for character. The plot hook is, you know, practically non-existent. It is really just kind of a string of fight scenes and chase scenes.
So like she's escaped from New York.
Yeah, I guess. There you go. It does kind of feel Carpenter-esque, too.
Yeah, but there's nothing as great as an escape from New York, you know?
It doesn't have that same social commentary.
Yeah, or the dialogue isn't that great either.
The interesting thing is, you know, this is... I think probably the last movie before Walter Hill hooked up with Ry Cooter for all of his scores. And so it's got, you know, that same kind of synthy late 70s, early 80s feel that Escape from New York has and a lot of Carpenter scores have.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I would say it's unique, you know, in his filmography. Is that a word? As far as, you know, the tone of the score and the tone of the whole movie is just really, really distinctive.
I always kind of joked that it was the best score that John Carpenter never did.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great over that opening, you know, all the gangs flooding into the subways. And I think that's probably the strongest part of the movie, to be honest, is, you know, setting up the concept, the idea of these guys going to this meeting with all the other gangs, 9 guys, no guns, and this really cool early synth score going over top. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'd say the opening is the part I enjoyed the most, that and the part where they're stuck with the band of girls.
Yeah, that was pretty good. The Lizzies.
Yeah, the Lizzies. And, like, there's this big shot, like, where he looks at the door and they dealt both in, and that's very Walter Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That scene was pretty sparse. It was like, and even like the set, it almost looked like, you know, a few couches pulled onto a soundstage.
Probably was. I don't know how much money he was getting for his movies back then.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been a whole lot, I don't imagine.
Yeah, especially if you're considering mounting a near future alternate universe.
We all know that New York City looked like a dystopian nightmare in the 1970s anyway, so.
Fair enough.
How about you, John? The Bad.
Oh, The Bad. I'm going to go with Hill's, one of his late 80s, and Priest Johnny Handsome, the Mickey Rourke picture. You know, I really, really wanted to like Johnny Handsome, and I thought a revisitation on Blu-ray would have exposed my earlier boredom and dislike of the movie to have been due to the fickle attention span of a kid who was, you know, kind of expecting another Lethal Weapon. And going back to it again, sadly, that wasn't the case. Johnny Handsome is, for all that slick looks it's got, it's just an anemic non-experience. The movie starts, and what after what feels like 3 fucking hours, it just collapses into this busted heap. You know, I don't know if the story would need more time to be told, even though it's only a lean 93 minutes, but it just feels so long. I don't know if it's just in need of a really dire need of a rewrite. It's just really sloppy and unfocused. And unlike Extreme Prejudice, I was talking about, you know, how good the cast was in that. Johnny Handsome's got a lot of really good actors that amount to a lot of nothing. You know, Mickey Rourke was decent enough in it. As soon as he gets past the whole, you know, speaking through his nose from, I know why they did it, but it's terrible. Morgan Freeman was god awful in it.
I don't even remember Morgan Freeman in that movie.
Morgan Freeman was the cop who just wouldn't let go of, he was determined to put this guy back in prison, and Johnny was just a low-level thug. There's no reason for him to be dedicated to getting him off the street. And Forrest Whitaker. I hate Forrest Whitaker anyway, so this I'm probably a bit biased on this. But I went back and watching it, and I kept looking for the Forrest Whitaker eye.
I have to agree. Forrest Whitaker is especially bad in this, with his horrible, over-the-top Southern accent, and he's just like a walking bundle of mannerisms in this.
You just give him another chance. And, you know, as enjoyable as Lance Henriksen is playing villains, which, let's face it, that's pretty much all Lance Henriksen's really enjoyable is.
Yeah, I guess.
That's just another terrible, terrible character. And going back to Streets of Fire, I don't know what was with Johnny Handsome's pseudo-50s look.
I like Johnny Handsome. I think it's fair to say that John didn't. But, I liked it to a low degree, I'm going to say. I didn't love it by any means. But I think there are a few strong things about it. I mean, he uses New Orleans really well. Mickey Rourke, again, after he gets past the nasal enunciation, he's really good. You know, he sells that kind of, especially the scene where he, you know, he first sees his new face. He sells it in a nicely sort of understated way. He doesn't go over the top. I think probably where it fails the most is that this is a guy who's been seriously deformed his entire life. As soon as he's got his new face, I don't really buy that he'd suddenly be this super confident guy. I think there'd be a lot of residual sort of psychological problems going on, and you know, he wouldn't just be walking around, you know, swinging it and feeling like the top of the world.
And also, you don't really buy that, you know, he's gotten out of the hospital with this grand revenge scheme to bring down the ones who put him there in the first place and killed his mentor. Right, it's just, it just happens.
I think that Johnny Anton is a pretty forgettable flick. It's a nice neo-noir, but nothing more. That's it. It's nothing special.
I think, you know, you're still seeing all the style and panache of Walter Hill, but I really think Johnny Hanson's right. It's where he started to move down. You know, his career started his downturn at that point.
Maybe he started his downturn
with the Streets of Fire game, but didn't pay off. But you know, I really think Extreme Prejudice was a strong movie.
I agree. I do.
I really like Geronimo, which is post Extreme Prejudice. I think.
Mm-hmm. I think you know he had some good movies after it, but it definitely was one that I think he lost control of, maybe over what he was trying to do. I don't know the production history on it, but it really didn't come off as though it was something that was a smooth production and really came out as what the director intended.
And that's probably the gist of it. It probably just, I mean, I know Rourke had a reputation for being difficult and stuff as well. So maybe just at the end of the day, Hill just didn't get what he wanted, you know?
I figure they started making a movie about a guy who looked completely normal, and after Mickey Rourke started pissing Walter Hill off enough, he just changed the concept and put him in that mask.
And at least it gave Mickey Rourke some practice before he played Marv in Sin City.
Exactly. It's like peering into the future.
Did we do... Andrew, did you do your bad?
I did not.
All right, go for it.
My bad is Trespass, which, again, you know, it's not a movie I hate by any means, but it really feels like it's trying to be two things at once. And I think probably part of that is the fact that it's based on a Robert Zemeckis, Bob Gale script. And I can't think of two filmmakers sort of less alike than Robert Zemeckis and Walter Hill.
Yeah, really.
In sensibility. So, you know, you've got this, in a sense, kind of escapist Hollywood hook, which is there's this treasure that's been lost. Not just treasure, religious-themed gold. So, you know, you're starting this Jewel of the Nile kind of approach, and then it's trying to marry that with, like, a pretty urban gang drama combined with exploring the racial legacy of America. I don't think it really works. You get some performances in it. Bill Paxton and help me out, guys. What's the
William
other
name? Sadler. William Sadler.
That's the one. Yeah. William Sadler. Apologies to William Sadler. You know, they're good. Ice Cube's in it. He's really good. And so basically the premise I should probably start off by explaining is these two firefighters from Arkansas, I believe, find, while they're in this fire, a rather raving lunatic who is saying something about hidden gold and hands them something. And they discover that in St. Louis, there is a treasure that has been hidden after a robbery. They decide that they're going to go explore it in this, they believe, abandoned area. At the same time, there's a gang hit going on. They're taking this guy out of the way to get rid of him. Ice-T, along with Ice Cube, are members of a gang. They want to get rid of this guy. Bill Paxton sees them tossing him off a roof. And from then on, it becomes Bill Paxton and William Sadler locked in a room with the gold that the gang doesn't know about. They're trying to find it, and the gangs kind of break in because the two, I don't know if you want to call them the protagonists, but William Sadler and Bill Paxton have managed to grab Ice-T's little brother. So they've got him in the room.
I forgot about that.
So Ice-T's little brother, played by the limo driver from Die Hard, is a junkie. He's, you know, he's in bad shape, and so they're using him as a bit of a hostage, trying to figure out how they're going to get out of this. So you've got sort of that Rio Bravo guys locked in a room being assaulted kind of setup. And so it really feels like you've got trying to be a Hollywood sort of escapist blockbuster on that side. And then mixing in this kind of white guys from another state coming in into supposedly, you know, black gang territory and it's not really well explored, I think. There's some good performances, as I said, and some good action, but it just doesn't feel like
one or the other. And it certainly doesn't feel like a genuine portrayal of what a real gang would be.
No.
It kind of feels like the Hollywood version. So, yeah.
These guys saw Boys in the Hood and missed the point completely.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it works in a great double feature with Judgment Night.
I don't think it's as good as Judgment Night.
It probably isn't. For my bad, I'm going with Last Man Standing, which... I know a lot of people kind of came down on the movie pretty hard after it came out and stuff like that.
I walked out of the theater.
John walked out of the theater. See, I love
No, I walked out of the theater when the end credits started.
Oh, fine. But no, for what it was, you know, for a sheer just total exercise in style, I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was kind of a return to form for Hill. It was kind of more along the lines of his late 70s stuff. Like, it was more along the lines of The Driver or even, you know, Long Riders or Southern Comfort. Like, it had that more gritty, that darker, almost, you know, stage production quality to it. And I really enjoyed the performances. I really enjoyed walking in there. I really enjoyed Bruce Willis in it, you know.
That was one of Willis's better, because he was getting really sloppy and lazy at that point.
Yeah, this was around the same era that brought us, like, Mercury Rising and stuff like this. So, you know, it was nice to see Willis play a hard ass.
Willis has two speeds. He's got Sleepy and he's got John McClane.
Yeah. But, no, I just, you know, it was a flick that, as a remake of Yojimbo, which at that point I hadn't seen, and Fistful of Dollars, which I had seen at that point. You know, like, I just thought it was really cool as kind of more of a, you know, the Prohibition era modernized Western and stuff. But I could definitely see people thinking that it was, you know, kind of, again, more style than substance and kind of a creatively bankrupt remake of a film that really didn't need to be remade, which I guess is kind of true. But at the same time, I think it's probably my favorite telling of that particular story, which might get me branded as a lunatic, but I'm cool with that.
I think the problem with it, one of the problems is the pacing. Walter still seemed to lose pacing after Extreme Prejudice. Like, his films kept on dragging along, and they're only 90 minutes long.
Trespass definitely had pacing issues.
And the other big problem is that it takes place in an empty town, whereas, like, in both Yojimbo and Fistful of Dollars, you have actually people living in the town that are afraid and stuff, and that takes some of the drama out of the story.
And that was where I kind of got the stage production vibe, was the whole empty town, you know?
You know, I think that's probably the main flaw I see with it, is that it seemed hard that he could play two sides against each other without being found out, you know, when they're basically the only inhabitants of the town, which takes up the space of about a half a block. But I really like this movie, and probably it's not entirely defensible, but just, you know, the action of it, it feels to me like it's Walter Hill paying a bit of tribute to some of the Hong Kong action movies that had come out at that point. I mean, there's a ton of just totally absurd physics and two-fisted guns just annihilating the scenery, and lots of slow motion. Just as a pure escapist action movie, I just love it. But again, it's so lightweight. I mean, there's hardly anything to it, and it's definitely Willis in his smug and weary mode.
I still love that one line he says, the walk, and the one that I remember sitting in the theater watching it, and the audience actually laughed hysterically, was the, "I'm going to have to kill you. And if I kill you, it's going to hurt."
I have to mention, did Christian Bale steal his Batman voice from Christopher Walken in Last Man Standing?
He may have. He definitely took lessons from.
Christopher Walken is one of the highlights of the movie, though, I think it's mentioning. I mean, it's not a subtle performance, I think it's fair to say.
It's just a performance he gave into Romance.
As a Tommy gun-wielding, scar-faced gangster, he's pretty hard to not enjoy it.
It's entertainment. Now we get to the ugly, the Walter Hill movie that you just completely hated, that you have no time for it, that, you know, if you never see it again, it will be too soon. Gabriel, what have you got?
I've got the Red Heat.
Leave Jim Belushi alone.
I thought
he lost his brother.
It's a fairly limp variation in the buddy cop comedy, and there's no chemistry between Belushi and Schwarzenegger. Belushi is just mugging, and Jim Belushi has never been good.
To be fair, when has Schwarzenegger had history with anyone?
Well, except from Danny DeVito, maybe.
That DeVito had to work twice as hard on that movie, okay?
But yeah, it's just boring. I mean, it's an action movie, and I'm bored, and the storytelling is rote, and there's nothing interesting in it.
I love that villain, though, so much.
I knew this movie was going to catch some shit, so I kind of thought about some of the good things about it, because I kind of like it. Again, it's not a good movie, but I think one of the things that sort of saves it is it doesn't sort of try to go over the top of the buddy cop comedy aspect, and it plays it straight at the right times, and it's also got, you know, one of the classic "Hey, it's that guys" in Edo Ross as the Georgian drug dealer they're going after. He's just got one of those awesome, awesome 80s villain faces. And I kind of wish he'd been in more stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of weak.
How about you, Jen? What's your ugly?
Oh, do I have a doozy for you guys? There can be only one.
It's probably my choice as well.
Supernova.
Yeah.
I don't even want to talk about this pile of garbage. We should probably do this together.
Okay, go ahead.
Supernova was one of those movies that should have been left in the development hell it had been languishing in since 1988.
Was it that long?
Yeah, it was one of the 80s creature feature directors. You never really heard of, like, Steve Miner or one of those guys.
Oh, okay.
That was one of his dream projects. And originally it was supposed to be, you know, kind of twisted in the Event Horizon vein. But that's obviously not what came to screen.
No.
No, you know, between the reshoots by Jack Sholder and editing by Francis Ford Coppola, 2FC.
Yeah, Mr. Coppola.
And, you know, the fact that Hill didn't even want his name attached to the movie. What do you use, Thomas Lee?
Yeah, it was the first non-Alan Smithy movie, I believe.
Thank you, Burn Hollywood Burn.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's, like, you gotta wonder how much is left on the screen that even resembles Hill's work. You know, it's plagued with the late 90s CG that's aged horribly, and there's really nothing going on there that justifies the $90 million price tag.
That movie cost $90 million.
As an aside, you guys remember when $90 million was, like, exorbitant budget?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And let's just
say, I don't know, I watched this yesterday, and the only reason I didn't kill myself, I had laundry to do today.
let's just face facts. I mean, Spader.
The set looked like Earth Final Conflict.
James Spader is the worst action hero in Hollywood history. Every time he's on screen, he just sweats this stink of smarmy douche. It just, like, comes out of his pores. And Angela Bassett would have made a perfect Terminator.
And at points, it almost feel like it could be like one of those Shannon Twohey direct-to-video softcore movies.
It kind of, like, it seemed like it was going to go that way. I mean, it's like, it's a softcore movie without enough. It's like, it's limpcore. It's flaccid core.
And what'd you guys think of all the bargain basement, like, sci-fi techno battle about ninth dimensional matter? And, you know, the ending was probably the stupidest thing I've ever seen. And, you know, we're talking about, you're at a point now in movies, the late 90s and the early, what do we call them, the knots? The noughties?
I refuse to use the term noughties, I'm sorry.
The, 2000 wasn't a great year for movies anyway. And, I mean, over the past few years, we suffered through, let's just call it shit, like Mimic and Phantoms. You know, all of our expectations have been lowered.
Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms, yo.
Even after Phantoms and Mimic, I still couldn't muster any caring for Supernova.
I will.
And the villain, I mean, is played by Peter Facinelli, who's, like, the least charismatic. I don't know. He seems like, you know, if you took Chris Evans, Matthew McConaughey, and Tom Cruise, they somehow formed a child, and then they gave him a personality bypass.
I like the knuckle punching.
That's what you'd have.
Dragging his two fists against each other, sparks shoot out in the movie.
What? Why don't I remember this? Can we watch the same movie?
I think you just watched Event Horizon again.
I probably did.
I've read online that at one point it was supposed to be the Hellraiser in space movie, and Hellraiser 4 was also designed by its director, but it's still better than Supernova.
Ouch! Oh, that's just...
When you're not as good as a direct-to-video Hellraiser sequel, you're in trouble.
I saw Hellraiser Bloodlines in theater.
Maybe that's what we're going to say Supernova.
Maybe it is. All I remember about it was it had an awesome trailer for The Crow City of Angels, and we all know how that turned out.
Dude, Supernova had an awesome trailer, too. Editors can make anything look good.
All I remember from the Supernova trailer is lots of purple, and that's basically all the movie was.
Yeah, the movie was purple, light purple show. And orange, so that was the color scheme.
How about you, Andrew? What's your ugly?
My ugly, I mean, it's nowhere near as ugly as Supernova, but neither was Mickey Rourke or Johnny Hansen. So it's Wild Bill, which I think probably must have been a troubled production. I don't know the history of it, but it feels really chopped up. It's, you know, it's got a lot of things going for it. It's got Jeff Bridges. It's John Hurst. I mean, it's Walter Hill doing a Western about one of these iconic characters. But it just feels so episodic, and everything's broken up. And then it's definitely not helped by Hill's really, really just insane choice to have these moments where he suddenly switches to black and white video, which obviously it just takes you right out of the movie. It feels like you're in... I don't know, like a mid-90s TV series with a character going on a vision quest. Like, it's just like the worst kind of psychedelic... I don't even know what to say. I hate this movie. And it really pissed me off that in the trailer, the one thing in the trailer that made me want to see this movie was these two bullets flying at the camera, and it didn't make the final cut. Or I blinked.
I almost picked Wild Bill as my bad, because I don't hate the movie.
Jeff Bridges is awesome.
Yeah, I definitely acknowledge that it's put together piss poorly, but to me it has a lot of the same flaws as The Long Riders. It feels a little more episodic than it should, and I don't know if it was that. Was Wild Bill a theatrical film, or was it a TV show? Was it like
a
miniseries?
Wild Bill was a theatrical film.
It was theatrical?
It didn't last. I think we only got it on video.
Oh, okay. Right on. Yeah, because I remember it was one of those movies that I kind of...
It was right in that period. I'm young enough, I can say that it like, the trailer was one of those trailers I remember as being, you know, in that adolescent period of my life where anything with cool action-y stuff just looked awesome. And I was psyched to see it, and when I finally got around to it, it was just... I think it's unfair to the Long Riders to say that its flaws line up at all, because the Long Riders, I think, is just a beautiful movie. It feels like everyone kind of ran out of energy halfway through, and then some studio hack had to come in to assemble the thing.
and I mean, we don't really know. Like, I don't know the gist of what went on behind Wild Bill, because to be honest with you, it was a movie I didn't even know existed until about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. And then when I saw it and saw that it was a Walter Hill movie, I kind of lost my mind. A little bit, and. I did, like, I mean, for what it was, I enjoyed it because I'm a Western freak anyway, and I'm a Walter Hill fan. So, I mean, you know, yeah, I did kind of enjoy it, but, and I guess when I compare it to The Long Riders, I do so in a favorable light, not so much to diminish Long Riders. But I do, like, again, I realize, I totally acknowledge that Wild Bill was a mess.
It should be noted, though, it has, you know, in one of its sort of mini episodes, it's got a really great scene. Where Bruce Dern, as a sort of crotchety old dad in a wheelchair, calls Wild Bill out for a gunfight in the middle of the street, and you know, Wild Bill, you know, being the guy he is, insists that he be tied to a chair to even the odds, you know, which is kind of, it's that kind of iconic moment that I think should have been, that approach to it, you know, could have been carried through the rest of the movie. I say that so easily, like I could just do that. But I mean, that's the movie I wanted to see, and it just, it wasn't, you know, it was a highlight in a very dark 90 minutes.
Best part of Wild Bill is probably all these little scenes at the beginning where you see him defeating all these people. And after that, it just feels 3 hours long, and it's only 98 minutes long.
So again, with pacing issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he work?
And actually, you know, oddly enough, I think the thing that would have benefited it was a little more breathing. I think if it was longer, it would have felt shorter, because you would have felt those connections through the different parts of his life.
Yeah,
and it's that choppiness that really just makes it feel incredible.
Yeah.
Well, my choice for...
It never has a chance to gain any... Go ahead, Steve.
My choice for ugly, mine is actually the same as John's, so I won't get into too much detail there, but I am going to say Supernova. Just when I look through his body of work, it's really the only thing he's done that I out-and-out hate. It's the only one that I, you know, that I just kind of... I knee-jerk and dart away from, like, ew, Supernova! You know, it's... just such a horrible misfire on every level. It's, you know, it's a completely incompetent film. I don't think it's something, I know a lot, like a lot of the stories where that Hill, you know, had finished a cut and turned it in and the studio hated it and all this kind of stuff. I wonder, you know, what had he done? Like, that they deemed so much worse than what they actually released. I have to wonder, like, I mean, is this a situation where you had a bunch of producers whose heads were so far up their assholes that they went in and said, let's try to salvage something out of this, you know, this take on Solaris or something like this. But maybe it was too slow. Maybe it had lots of pacing issues or something. Maybe it was more of a Solaris when they were expecting a Pitch Black, you know, or something like that. But what ended up being released was just, it wasn't released.
Maybe it didn't end with an explosion.
Yeah, it wasn't released. It was unleashed, you know, on an unsuspecting menace. It was just...
I think it was diagnosed.
Yeah. Yeah, you got a case of the supernovas.
But still born, basically.
Oh, it was just... Oh, like, production value was so bad. The sets were kind of cool. If I got to say anything nice about it, I'll say the set... Like, it had a nice look to the sets and stuff, but it was just filmed and put together in such a haphazard fashion, and then with all these crappy effects, it was just... Oh, what a mess of a movie.
You know, I think probably, you know, it was developed for someone else. Maybe Hill looked at it and thought this was his chance to direct Alien. And maybe the concept wasn't thought out well enough or something. But, yeah, it just did not come together. It's like the Inside Out monkey from The Fly.
Yeah.
That's basically what we ended up with.
And it's a situation, I think, too, you know, where you got a director known for gritty action, westerns, and you give him a science fiction film. Like, imagine Sam Peckinpah doing a movie about people flying to Mars. It doesn't sit.
Dude, I'm thinking about Sam Peckinpah with laser guns, and that is the greatest thing ever.
Let's dig him up.
Let's dig up Bloody Sam.
I'm pretty sure Joe Carnahan's his illegitimate son anyway.
Yeah, probably. And I could I'd equally be disturbed by Kit the thought of Carnahan doing an outer spacey science fiction movie. I think that's all our bases covered on Walter Hill. I had thought of something that I was going to throw on the end there, but it's gone. I lost it.
Do we have any? Maybe just want to sort of go over some final thoughts overall on some of his movies that we didn't touch on.
Here we go.
I mean, I'd like to talk about The Long Riders because. And none of us really dealt with it in detail, but it's one of those movies that I was really torn. You know, I kind of wanted to make The Long Riders my good, because it's one of the great westerns that just came out at a time, I think, when people weren't buying them anymore.
I mean, there were a few great westerns in the 80s. I mean, there was, you know, you had Pale Rider, which was, you know, Eastwood's, one of his, I mean, outside of Unforgiven, his last great Western, you know, and you had The Long Riders, and outside of that, from the 1980s, I can't think of very much. There was that one with Danny Glover and Kevin Costner and Silverado, which was,
Silverado.
You know, kind of a big blockbuster approach to Westerns, but The Long Riders was like the last of the real pure classic westerns. Like it, that had that classic feel to it, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, had an awesome one, but I think it was a TV movie.
What was that? Yeah, Shadowrunners. Yeah.
Right, now you want to talk about testosterone. There you go, Tom Selleck and Sam Elliott. Let the mustache duel begin.
But yeah, Long Riders, I think some of the brilliance in Long Riders, and I mean, I know whenever you see anything on Long Riders, this is always what comes up, is the fact that he cast brothers as brothers.
That was an excellent touch. It's kind of refreshing to see relatives on screen actually looking like each other.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing that he was able to find, you know,
four sets of brothers that didn't suck.
The brothers that he needed who are all really good actors.
Yeah.
The other thing about it is, and something that sort of came back in Broken Trail, which he did for TV years later, was it has this really sort of elegiac, mournful feel. Like, you can tell, you know, he's making a classic Western, but he's also sort of marking the fact that it's going away.
Yeah, it's got that same kind of the West is dead vibe that stuff like The Wild Bunch has.
Exactly.
Yeah, you have that same kind of feel in Geronimo as well, which I really like too.
Yeah, Geronimo was a pretty good, and that's another one. That's another prime example. I mean, Hill's westerns in general have been, outside of Wild Bill, which was a bit of a misfire, sure, but like his westerns in general have been, you know, pretty well acquitted, pretty well presented, you know, well put together movies. Like Broken Trail was fantastic.
Well, you got to wonder with Wild Bill if he was trying to make a classic western and the studio wanted something on the grounds of Unforgiven, Tombstone.
Tombstone, more of an action movie.
Fistfuls of cash.
Yeah, fistfuls of dollars.
Yeah. Let's see.
I mean, I'd say the irony is that, you know, The Long Riders, even though it has that tone, has some really good action in it. It's got some really good gunfights. All the action is really well shot and edited. And, I mean, if you want to talk about some of the best shots, just pure shots in Walter Hill's movies, there's some really good ones in this. Like, they're ambushed. The gang is ambushed at a cabin where they're laying low. And while the Pinkertons are shooting at them, they sort of go out the back way. And you've got these eight guys or so just tumbling down this ravine bank, and it's just this amazing, amazing shot, and the movie is just filled with those.
Yeah, it does have a lot of great moments.
Yeah.
I also, I really like The Driver a lot, and that was kind of another one that I kind of hemmed and hawed a lot over whether or not I'd include it, because it was just such a stylish exercise, and at the time when I'd seen it, again, it was one of those movies, you know, I picked it up on a bargain rack at Walmart, and saw it directed by Walter Hill, and I was like, oh, crap, you know, and brought it home and fired it up right away and watched it. And was, again, like, I walked away at the end, and I was like, man, that was a really cool little movie. Like, it just, it kind of starts and it ends, and when it's done, you know, it's not something you think deeply about. It's not something that's going to leave you, you know, mind blown or anything like that. But it was so effective. It was so well executed, you know?
And I think it's a little bit of an oddity to his filmography. It feels very European. I mean, there's a lot. It feels like a bit of a Jean-Pierre Melville flick.
Yeah, and there's
absolutely. It's the samurai. Like,
yeah,
through and through.
And there's
awesome car chase.
There's Isabelle Adjani too in there too for that factor.
One of the few cases where, you know, alongside maybe Barry Lyndon, you know, It's a perfect thing for Ryan O'Neill, because you need that sort of blank cipher.
Yeah.
And you know, he's perfect for it, because he's this complete loner. He doesn't even have a name. Nobody in the movie has a name, and he does what he does, and that's all he does.
I love the little twist at the end too, you know, how the guys who hire him and plan on double crossing him, their whole plan hinges around the fact that he's been said earlier on, you know, it said that he doesn't carry a gun. It's like, hey, guess what? Surprise! <You
know>? Yeah, it feels very like a classic.
See, I didn't know how.
A classic noir.
I love the Trans Am. I'm a child of the 70s. I love the Trans Am.
We know.
I was kind of surprised, actually, really surprised. We didn't, I mean, what else is there to say about it? But we didn't really talk at any length about 48 Hours, you know, kind of one of the movies that kind of shaped the 80s.
Oh, and we absolutely should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it did create the formula.
Yeah. I mean, no, when
you... One of the things, you know, it's not back at 48 hours.
Fantastic action movie, but there's just something about it. It's got this X factor. Everything in it just seems to...
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think, like, something a lot of people forget about.
When you compare it to a Fractacular sequel...
Ugh.
Ugh.
You get to see Eddie Murphy
before you look at it.
Fame has swelled his ego.
What was that, Andrew?
I'll actually talk now. Okay. One of the things about it that's really interesting is like looking back at it is, you know, you could be forgiven for remembering Nick Nolte's character in it as sort of one of those like Hollywood friendly, curmudgeonly, mildly offensive characters. He's just a straight out racist. Like, and that's one of the things about this movie is, you know, it's got this character who's not your sort of dirty, hairy general misanthrope. He just hates black people a lot. And it's kind of disturbing going back to this movie and sort of trying to figure out in your head how you're supposed to react to this, because ostensibly it's a comedy. In a lot of ways, and there's some stuff, certainly for my generation, you know, we've been brought up to be very sensitive to how we deal with people from other cultures and who don't look like us. And then you watch this movie that came out in the mid-80s and was a blockbuster, basically, and you've got Nolte calling Eddie Murphy spear chucker. Like, this is definitely, you know, I'm not equipped to deal with this movie.
Hours. Half the success, 48. I remember reading a story that they didn't expect the movie to do anything and only had a budget of $1 million, right? So you're talking about an 800%
improvement on your investment.
On your investment. They said they knew they had a hit on their hands. There were people falling out of the aisles laughing at the torchy scene, the redneck bar, when Eddie Murphy... Basically, his big improv scene in it.
Yeah.
Right? This is where he became the money kid of the 80s. Was, and they said,
48 hours was his big time. 48 hours was his shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you get
that scene is sort of the quintessential Eddie Murphy, you know, riffing on camera kind of scene. I'd say the only problem I have with that scene is I find it really hard to buy Eddie Murphy as a tough guy. Like, so the idea,
especially when
even though he had a badge, the idea that he's been intimidating these 6'5" cowboys just didn't really work for me. But, you know, he is great in it.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is he's just beginning. So he's more laid back, and he's not as outrageous as he would become. And I think he's actually believable as a badass in that movie, more than, like, Beverly Hills Cop. Say.
Yeah, definitely.
And...
Going
back to how awful I thought the villain was in Supernova, I thought, and you talked about how you wanted to punch James Remar in the mouth every time he opened his mouth in the Warriors. I thought he was absolutely fantastic in 48 Hours. Like
if you've got Nick Nolte's character, you've got to have someone several degrees worse.
No, I got the same feeling that I got from the Shlomo that, oh God, what was that horrible Steven Seagal is out for lunch, the William Forsythe character?
Oh God.
No, you just get, Remar just right from the start of the movie is just, you know that this character is going, like, he's on a head-on collision, right? This guy, there's no way he makes it out of this movie alive. And you kind of, like, he kind of knows that, so it's just, he wants to go down as loudly and violently as possible.
Kind of like a, you know, it's one of those Gary Busey at the end of Lethal Weapon moments, right?
Yeah. Only without the suicide by cop thing, you know, it just, I still love when Nolte blows his brains out at the end of the movie. It's just, there's nothing to it, right?
And it's satisfying.
Yeah, and some people say, you know, it's kind of how odd Nolte, or how just horrible a person Jack was in 48 Hours. But to him, at the end of that, it's just he's got this look in his eyes that this is what it's come to. He's got to, you know, it's like he's putting down a dog.
And then you get the sequel, which might as well have been, you know, the Eddie Murphy Show. It was basically a Beverly Hills Cop sequel. It was horrible.
I think, you know, it was a good thing, you know, talking there, you know, calling it, saying it's like putting down a dog, because I think that's the big difference between, you know, there's a mustache twirling villain and there's this kind of villain who, you know, neither, I wouldn't say either kind has any more depth, but, you know, the sort of mad dog approach to it is, I think, more believable. And,
especially when you got a guy that looks like a legitimate dirtbag playing it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, Willem Dafoe in Streets of Fire is a bit of the same cloth.
So you better not start insulting Raven Shattuck.
No, he was just, yeah, he saw what he wanted and he took it, you know? I love Streets of Fire.
it's amazing.
Like the kind of glam rock evolution of Luther from the Warriors.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, just out for kicks, right?
Yeah.
He did it because it seemed like a good idea at the time.
So to sum it up, guys, in one paragraph, we'll start with Gabriel. Your thoughts in general on Walter Hill?
Well, I think he's done more great and good movies than he's done bad stuff. He's a very interesting director, interested in honor and masculinity, and he's got a distinctive style and stuff to say. So I had a great time watching all these movies.
How about you, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, you can't deny, looking back, that he basically was one of the key guys of the late 70s and 80s. Even something like Supernova, you know, even something that bad, I don't think there's ever a case where he just, you know, gets tired and kind of hands it in. I think he's always trying for something. And he's one of those guys who's able to, at least for a little while, he was able to straddle that line between having sort of a personal vision and connecting with the box office, which, you know, was elusive for a lot of his career. But for a time, he really hit that, and I'd say that's worth mentioning.
How about you, Jen?
I think Hill kind of deserves a little bit more than he's gotten. Unfortunately, we all know that, you know, it's not always the quality of your work that determines how successful you are. And I'm really glad that, you know, Hill's getting one more movie in the theater, right? It'd be really sad to see a guy like that run out on TV and DVD.
Yeah.
When you consider, like, how much he's... When we first said we were going to do Walter Hill, when I look back at his IMDb page, when you got it all right there in front of you, it actually is kind of eye-opening, the amount of good stuff he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll just say, you know, he's definitely one of the most interesting filmmakers to come out of the 1970s. I mean, there were so many guys who either came and went in the blink of an eye, you know, did one or two movies and then vanished, or guys who just droned on for far too long and faded into obscurity, or guys who, you know, became the new moguls, the new studio runners, you got your Spielbergs and your Lucases. But Hill is one of those rare directors who's always kind of, I mean, from a stylistic standpoint, he's always had an interesting eye. He's always shot the hell out of a picture. And he's just got a really unique look to his films that, like, he's got this earthiness, this lack of polish, this lack of post-production on a lot of his movies. I mean, yeah, they can be borderline glossy at times, but even when you get into the really high gloss stuff like Streets of Fire or The Warriors, it still has this, you know, in camera look to it. Like, there wasn't a lot done with it in post production in terms of editing and you know, flashy camera tricks or filters or anything like this. He's got a real in the moment style that I like, and
there's a lot of texture.
Yeah, yeah, and he's definitely got an interesting choice in material, like a subject matter. He sticks to what he knows. He sticks to his action and that sort of stuff, but he really does a good job of making each of his films kind of feel unique. No two films really feel alike, and that keeps him interesting. On that note, we will leave you. Be sure to tune in again when we come back. We'll update accordingly. I'm sure there's going to be Facebook presence. There's DVD Verdict Presents. You should subscribe to us on iTunes. I'm sure we'll show up in the DVD Presents feed at some point. But be sure to tune in next time when we tackle... Who are we going to tackle next time?
Catherine Bigelow.
Catherine Bigelow. She of Strange Days and K-19, The Widowmaker and The Hurt Locker, you know, fairly well known. But again, probably another director similar to Hill in terms of, you know, her work is probably more well known than she is. So be sure to join us. I'm sure that's going to be interesting. Thanks, guys, for taking the time out.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Good night.
Have a good one.
Ciao.